fellow by the name of Sonny Limbo. Interesting story about Sonny. I got an air check from Sonny. It was good. I checked his references. They were good. Sonny came to work for us and was the worst person I ever heard on the air. I learned that Sonny Limbo was probably one of the finest people in the world with a razor blade. He could splice like nobody else. The story on Sonny Limbo, he went back to his home, which was down in Huntsville, Alabama, and later he produced a song called My Home is Alabama, and he was the man behind the beginning of the group, Alabama.
Oh, wow.
And later, he wrote and produced the song Key Largo with Bertie Higgins. I talked to Bertie about a year ago, and I think that Sonny Limbo is also not with us anymore. Another interesting name from the, I guess it must have been the middle 60s, around 65, was a fellow named Johnny Alligator Argo. And Argo worked 7 to midnight, but for a very short period of time. He was a character. He had worked for Todd Stores. I think he worked at WHB in Kansas City. And Argo was an interesting guy. He drove a Corvette, and he kept a case of vodka in the trunk because he felt that he needed to make a drink to go from his apartment to the nearest, you know, Waffle House or Toddle House. And so he'd just walk out and fix himself a drink and then drive to work. Interesting guy. And he was another of the characters. You have the name of Ben Fletterer, who was Rudy Ratfink. Ben Fletterer was a good personal friend of Jerry Barr's. They both came from Peoria, Illinois.
Yeah, what's the story with Jack Sanders and Jerry Barr? A lot of people have written in about them being caught with underage girls in a hotel, and that did them in as far as Louisville radio is concerned. Is there any truth to that?
No truth to Jerry Barr. There was truth to Jack Sanders. Jack Sanders didn't get caught. Jack Sanders had some kind of an affair with an underage girl. But what made the story interesting is that Jack Sanders was not caught with the girl. The girl was caught on Dixie Highway in a prostitution sting in one of the motels out there. And in the course of the interrogation from the detective said, "Is there anyone else?" And this girl started spouting out name after name after name after name. And she said, "And then, of course, there's my boyfriend." And there was a big pause, and they said, "And who is your boyfriend?" And she said, "Jack Sanders." And that's how Jack got pulled into the thing. Joel Thrope and I went to the police station that night. Jack was charged by the police. The owner of Lynn Broadcasting, Red Gregg, came to Louisville. We all met in his hotel room. And then that night, Joel and I went down to talk to the detectives in hopes that there would be something that we could do, and there was nothing. And they were proceeding with, their charging of him with carnal knowledge of a minor. As it turns out, an attorney who had an office on the fifth floor of the Kentucky Home Life building across the hall from the radio station was a well-known criminal defense attorney by the name of Rush Nicholson. And Rush Nicholson took Jack's case because he knew Jack and he liked Jack. Supposedly, this tryst between Jack and the girl occurred in a apartment which was on a cul-de-sac, and the girl went to the apartment in a cab. Well, they couldn't find the cul-de-sac anywhere in the city of Louisville, and they couldn't find the cab driver. As a result, in like somewhere between, it was either 45 seconds or 45 minutes, and that I'm not sure about, the jury came back and acquitted Jack.
Now, what did that do for his radio career?
His radio career moved from there to Nashville. He went to Nashville, I think, and went to work. But I think he actually went down there and worked for Audrey Williams, the widow of Hank Williams.
Now, just going back to what happened at Wacky, as soon as this hit the papers, did you guys pull him off the air?
Pulled him off the air immediately, and that's when Rusty Reynolds entered the picture. Rusty and I had worked at KDOK in Tyler, and I knew Rusty had pretty much of what was called in Texas radio the Art Nelson sound. Art Nelson had been one of McClendon's jocks at KLIF in Dallas. And Rusty had emulated Art almost to perfection. And Rusty had worked for Marie Gifford at KEEL in Shreveport. So when I called Rusty, he came, and I guess he spent maybe a year with us in Louisville. And the latest on Rusty, incidentally, is I understand he and his partner, Mr. Osborne, sold all of their stations in Texas and Mississippi, but that Rusty now owns a station again somewhere, I think, either in Longview or Kilgore. Bill Crisp, Bill Bailey, and Johnny Randolph were all at WKLO during the periods of time that I was there.
Well, let's talk about WKLO.
Okay.
Now, depending upon who you talk to, a lot of folks say that Wacky was completely dominant in Louisville in the 60s, but some KLO folks have said that's not true. Was it a battle back and forth
you
with the ratings?
You betcha. And first of all, I want to give great credit. KLO had one of the great program directors I've ever known. As a matter of fact, it was a husband and wife team of program directors. It was Terrell Matheny and his wife Carolyn Matheny. He used the air name of Mitch Michaels, and they were a viable competitor. I mean, it was a toe-to-toe heavyweight championship fight.
As far as the lead was concerned with KLO and Wacky, did it just constantly change hands through the 60s?
It did change back and forth. I'm inclined to say that we may have won more than we lost, but they were a good competitor. They did not have, I guess, the position in the mind that Wacky had. Wacky bought a place in the people's hearts that KLO never had, and I think that was attributed to a lot of our success.
What other differences were there between the stations in the 60s?
I feel confident we had the edge in the news department. In the case of Sanders, we had the edge as far as air talent. Bailey had not come into the market, really, during my era. He came in toward the tail end, but I had basically gone on to do other things with Lynn when Bill arrived. And, you know, I knew right off the bat that he was a talent to be reckoned with. Bill Crisp had many similar talents to Bailey. Chris was a good-looking, almost Indian-looking guy, and very popular. Women loved him. And the difference between Crisp and Bailey is Crisp had a real warm, rich, masculine laugh that, you know, he'd just chuckle on the air. And he was good. He was excellent.
What about Tim Tyler?
Tim Tyler was not only a great disc jockey, but early on he realized that, you know, if you really want to make money in this business, you got to do something outside the station. And Tim and I put together some Beach Boy concerts. The picture you've got of the Beach Boys was at a concert that we put on. And the first one, we had very little invested in it and, you know, reaped a pretty good amount of money for our investment. The second one, we had to put in a lot more and reap less. And the third one, they wanted like $100,000, and I said, I don't want to do it. And Tim went ahead and did it. And I think Tim was very successful for a number of years in doing big promotions. A super guy. Excellent man.
What about some of the other premier names of the wacky talents that you worked with when you were PD?
George Williams, a real quiet guy. George was almost introverted, and he left us and went to Albany, Schenectady, Troy. I think he went to TRY in Troy, New York. George was one of the first PDs of Satellite Music Network.
Who else besides George?
Hal Smith. Hal was one of the most disciplined, organized guys I've ever seen. First of all, he was that way in his personal appearance, very impeccable. But Hal was the kind of guy, he was music director at one time during our time at Wacky. And if Hal didn't use a record, he immediately threw it away. So that if it became a hit 3 weeks from now, you didn't have a copy of it. He wanted the cleanest, most organized room in the world. And he was a very detailed, organized man. He was obsessive-compulsive. But he went out with Bell Ward and did a great job out in Los Angeles.
Who else can you think about?
Gene Snyder. Gene Snyder was the overnight guy after Jack Grady. Gene Snyder was one of those guys who always had grandiose dreams, but was always going to be relegated to being the all-night man. Whereas Jack Grady kind of, he got into it. That was his world. Those were his people. He enjoyed it. Gene really didn't. Gene wanted to be, you know, like a day jock, but it never came to pass for him. He finally went into the promotion business and started a company called Joni Records, which I saw on the website and all. Jerry Barr, I just remember, was a good kid and a decent disc jockey. And then Jay Reynolds, we had apartments down the road from each other. Jay was very, very handsome. Hal was a handsome man, but Jay was almost movie star him. Do you remember, as you went out going to Dixie Highway, there used to be a topless or stripper bar called the Merry-Go-Round? And every now and then, Jay would go in there, and Jay, he really liked this one girl that was a dancer. And so, you know, he'd go in and he'd see her every so often. And one night, Jay was in there, and this other good-looking girl walked up to him and said, if you touch my girlfriend or even say anything to her again, I'll deck you. And I guess Jay said, what do you mean you'll deck me? And apparently the gal decked him right then and there. It was a funny, funny story. But Jay's family hit oil up in Indiana. He was pretty comfortable by the time he got to WABC in New York. And he did that overnight thing at ABC for a number of years, maybe 4 or 5 years, and then came back to Indianapolis.
What about Harry Simpson? Did you work with him?
No, I did not.
Art Keller?
Art Keller, yes. Great guy. He left shortly after Bill Ward left. They both had been McClendon jocks, and when this new company came along, they decided that they wanted to move on. Now, Bill Ward, I think, went to Atlanta, but I never knew where Art went. Art was what you would call a great mid-morning jock, very smooth. good rapport with the audience.
Now, why did you leave the McClendon fold and decide to stay with Lynn Broadcasting when Lynn Broadcasting bought Wacky?
Namely, because right then, there was no place else to go in the McClendon group. That was about the time that Gordon was trying to decide what he was going to do with radio. Gordon put on an all-want-ad station called K-Ads in Los Angeles.
I heard about that.
He got to the point where he was just kind of experimenting. I think, to a degree, I think toward the end of the Wacky era, radio had kind of lost its luster to Gordon. I think he still longed for the days when he had his Liberty Network.
Now, looking back on your broadcast career, you're still actively involved in broadcasting in Gainesville today. How does Wacky measure up? Was Wacky one of the highlights or just kind of a stepping stone?
Oh, absolutely was the highlight. And I'll tell you why. Because Wacky as a radio station had an energy that I've never found anywhere else. Due in large measure to the staff. I mean, we all were in radio because we loved radio. And the other thing, nobody in that era at Wacky, including Sanders, had a contract. There was no such thing as a contract. You just had a job. And as long as you continued to deliver, you kept your job.
What about the Wacky studios, the Wacky offices? Tell me something about that.
Well, the old Wacky studios were in the Kentucky Home Life building. You know, this was the staid old bank of Louisville. It was at the corner of 4th and Jefferson, and the station was on the fifth floor. When I first got to Wacky, they had already broken the union of having board operators. Because apparently when Gordon first went into Louisville, the jock sat in an announce booth, and you had a board operator, and when you wanted the record to start, you had to point. And when you wanted him to give you the mic, you had to do all the, you know, the hand signals. When I got there, you could run your own board. That was fine. But when it came to cutting a spot, all you could do was go in and lay down a voice track. And there was a guy named Workman. He was a former military guy. He did all the production in the production room. And you were not allowed to step into the production room. And one of the biggest mistakes I ever made was one time there was a tape that was rewinding, and it came to the end of the reel, and the little arm didn't drop back down, so it just kept spinning. And I walked in and pushed the stop button, and the union threatened to go out on strike because I had entered their domain. They were just very particular about that. I don't remember when that came to an end. It may not have come to an end when I was still there.
Now, when we talked to Hal Smith, he mentioned during his time at Wacky, which ended in, I believe, 1962, that Wacky was still using all acetates on the air. They were not running any tapes for commercials or jingles or anything like that. Do you remember that transition period, and what was that like to go from acetates to using those newfangled tape cartridges?
I think Hal was right. I think we were late to get them. There was originally a thought that Ampex was coming out with a reproduction system that used a thing that was kind of like a dictaphone disc. It just kind of looked like a flat floppy. You could wad it up and everything, and then you could stick it in, and you could still play it. Because I know that Pam's had a bunch of those down there at the Jingle Place. And they never became the standard. And I think that at that time, the McClendon people were kind of holding out.
So did the jocks welcome having tape cartridges?
Oh, yeah.
You remember the transfer?
Sure. Oh, sure. It was revolutionary.
Now, you were there when Wacky moved to the 4th Street studios, right?
From 4th and Jefferson to the ones on 4th Street.
Now, WKLO had Showcase Studios, and Wacky decided they wanted to have Showcase Studios. Was that part of
Correct.
The deal?
Yeah.
Now, what was that like?
In the early days, the studios upstairs were the only thing that were on the upstairs level. Everything else was down in the basement. It was like going to a subterranean place. It was like going down to the bottom of a bank vault, and that's where the offices were, and then just the studios were upstairs.
Why was the decision made to move to Wacky's more contemporary 4th Street studios from its old location?
I think to be more in touch with the people, because we were in this lofty place in an old bank building, and the action of town was downtown, and you wanted to be on the visible 4th Street.
Now, you were on the air, too, as well as being a program director,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And what shift did you normally work?
When I first started there, I guess I worked 9 to noon, the shift that Keller may have had, because I think he may have been the first to go. And then when Bill Ward left, then I moved to mornings. I was a very bad morning man in the beginning, because I couldn't wake up. And Gene Snyder would call me. The one thing that Snyder learned real quickly, I would tell you any kind of lie that I wanted to tell you to get you off the phone. Like I'm in the shower, you know, I'm dripping wet. And he discovered I wasn't in the shower at all. I was still in bed. So if he continued to talk to me, then eventually I'd wake up and say, okay, I'll be there in a minute. So it worked, and I, you know, started to get the regimen where I, you know, got up on my own with no problem at all.
What could you tell me about the jingles that Wacky had on the air during your time there as program director?
We had the very best from PAMS. I think when we were getting them from PAMS in those days, Jim West or Toby Arnold was working at PAMS then. We had some from TM, from Tom Merriman, but we were basically a PAMS operation, and we went through the various PAMS regenerations like the Fun series, the Sonobox series. We always had excellent jingles. Now, if you ask me what I think are the best jingles I ever heard, that would be the WFIL Sound of Philadelphia jingles.
Oh, those were classic on Wacky. Those were incredible.
Those are my favorite.
Mine too.
As great as Bailey and Burbank and Dude Walker were, I have to put Sanders in that league. I was a very good, cheerful morning man. As far as being the all-time legendary personality, I probably could have done more now in retrospect, but it, you know, it was fun.
Tell us what you're doing exactly right now.
I work for a group called PAMAL, P-A-M-A-L Broadcasting. They own 9 stations in Florida. They own 7 in the Gainesville, Ocala area. I'm doing a legendary country station. It's the station I came down for. Has been country on and off for the better part of 30 years. It took a hiatus and became adult standards for about 12 years, but it's now classic country. And we've linked 3 stations together, 980 AM in Gainesville, 101.7 in Trenton, Florida, which is about 26 miles west, and then 1240 AM, 1,000 water in the town of Cross City, which is about 15, 16 miles on the other side of Trenton. So we're tri-casting.
And are you on the air?
Yes. Do mornings every morning.
Cool. And how old are you? Do you mind me asking?
71.